This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Over the last several years, especially after the tragedy in Newtown, the gun debate has become more heated and more divisive. At the core of the debate is the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it is those 27 words in that amendment that's cited by gun rights activists and by gun opponents alike.
The Second Amendment is there for a reason. The Founding Fathers firmly believed that Americans should have the right to protect themselves.
Hiding behind the Second Amendment can no longer be the shield for access. The people who wrote that document owned slaves, oppressed women, and were short on tolerance. I say to you tonight that times change, people's attitudes change, and it's time our lawmakers realize that society has changed, and despite the pressures of lobbyists, we need to move forward on gun violence in this country.
That's MSNBC host Ed Schultz, and before him, Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. Today, Where We Live, we'll continue a conversation about guns in the country and in Connecticut. We'll hear from a Bloomberg Businessweek reporter who wrote about Colt's legacy and the missteps in the gun world. And a new ProPublica project takes a look at where guns recovered by federal officials come from, state by state. We'll talk to one of the reporters behind that project. But first, Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His latest book is called The Second Amendment, A Biography. He joins us by phone. Michael Waldman, welcome to Where We Live.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us in the beginning why the Second Amendment was needed in the first place?
The Second Amendment is something we've been debating about and seeing through new eyes in each period of American history. And at the beginning, when it was first written, it came out of the debate over the Constitution and the fear that some Americans had that the new Constitution would create too strong a central government and in particular would threaten the militias of the 13 states. They were very worried that there would be an army, a national army, and that this could crush the militias, which they regard as a bulwark against tyranny. What does that have to do with gun ownership? People might be asking. Well, the militias were very different than anything we have now. In those days, every adult man, in fact, every adult white man eventually, was a member of the militia for their entire adult life. They were required by law to own a gun and to keep it at home. And this is what they were talking about as they debated the Constitution and debated the writing of the Second Amendment. It was a focus on individual gun ownership that is, you know, is different from the kinds of questions we grapple with today when we look at Connecticut's new gun laws or all the various ways that we talk about guns in the United States. But from the very beginning, it was an individual right. But at that point, to fulfill the civic duty of militia service. And you had guns and gun rights, but strong gun laws and public purpose alongside. And that's kind of how it's evolved over time.
I'd like to talk, as you do in your book, about some of the words in the Second Amendment. And I guess first, while you've described the status of militias at the time and their purpose in the early life of America, what do you think we mean by a well-regulated militia?
Well, of course, the Second Amendment, as we know, it's only 27 words. It's the shortest sentence in that way in the Constitution. It's confusing and self-contradictory, and we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what its clauses and commas mean. It starts, as you say, by saying a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, and then it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, one of the confusions for us is what does well-regulated mean? Of course, we think of regulation as being government. They actually didn't think of it that way in those days. We think that to them, the phrase well-regulated really meant more sort of well-behaved, disciplined, in good order.
So in good order is what we're talking about with regulation. But as with most of the words and even commas in this confusing sentence, this idea of regulation can mean different things to different people and probably has over the course of the last couple hundred years.
Well, that's right. Even back then when they talked about regulation of commerce, they meant the way we mean now. But when they talked about well-regulated militias, and that phrase turns up in a lot of state constitutions of the time, it seems like they meant something different. But, you know, people say, well, what about the security of a free state? Did they mean state like government generally, or do they mean states like Connecticut and Rhode Island and New York? You know, it is the case that everywhere else it appears in the Constitution, the word state means a state like Rhode Island or Connecticut. Then people have looked at the question of, well, what does it mean to bear arms? Does that mean just, you know, carrying around a gun? And sometimes people have looked at even things like dictionaries from the 1700s. This is something where the research for my book, The Second Amendment, a biography, really was interesting and somewhat surprising to me. Back then, it was pretty clear that the phrase bear arms meant military, had a military purpose. You can go on the Library of Congress website. They have a new thing they put up last year called the Founders Online, and it's the papers of Washington and Adams and Jefferson and Hamilton and Franklin and Madison. You know, the six most famous founding fathers, I guess you might want to call them that. And every time, just about, that the phrase bear arms is used by them or in their papers, it's referring to the military. So that's another question mark of what they really meant. We don't really know for sure what they meant. There's a real fog of history, and it's pretty clear that the world of the Second Amendment, this world of the militias, of civic duty, of kind of a universal draft, is very different from now, and it also vanished pretty quickly as soon as they put the Second Amendment into the Constitution.
And I'd like you to maybe describe how the Second Amendment was received at the time before we move forward into modern times. In its early history, what was the thought of the Second Amendment amongst most Americans?
Well, it's a great story, and I had a wonderful time learning and relearning the history of the ratification of the Constitution, how the Second Amendment got put in there in the first place. When they released the Constitution, which was intended to thrust toward a much stronger central government after the Constitutional Convention, because people thought that the country was kind of falling apart, including with violence, there was a huge debate of whether the states should ratify the Constitution. And what wound up happening was the idea that there would be amendments to change the Constitution even as it was being ratified and to perhaps put in a Bill of Rights. And dozens and dozens and dozens of amendments got recommended by the states and sent to Congress. And James Madison, who of course played the central role not only in conceiving of the Constitution as it eventually came to us, but of pushing through, writing, co-authoring the Federalist Papers, he was against there being a Bill of Rights. It's one of the great stories of how, you know, even that, it's really hard to know what the original intent was because they all had different ideas about what they were doing. And the politicians who actually wrote the Second Amendment didn't necessarily think the same thing that the public thought when it demanded it. Madison was against there being a Bill of Rights. But to win his first congressional election, he executed the first great flip-flop in American political history, said literally some variant of the modern politicians, well, circumstances have changed, and then vowed to go to Congress and pass amendments. He eventually proposed 17 amendments. It wasn't 10, like, you know, the Ten Commandments, the way we have it now. He proposed 17. He had a hard time getting the other people in Congress to take it all very seriously. His version of the Second Amendment, which was actually the Fifth Amendment, said that it reads similarly to what we have now, but it also had a conscientious objector clause saying that if you had religious scruples about bearing arms, you did not have to do your military service in person. And the whole debate in the floor of the House of Representatives was about the militias and this military service and the conscientious objector clause. The amendment was ratified. It didn't get much attention. It got a lot less attention than a lot of the other parts of the Constitution. And then pretty quickly, people stopped showing up for the militia duty. The country changed. We grew more individualistic. There were plenty of guns, and people felt they had a right to defend themselves. There were definitely lots of guns, and people had a right to have them. But there were also, at the same time, gun control and gun safety laws. You couldn't have a loaded gun in your home in Boston. There were limits to where you could fire guns in cities. The wrong kind of people couldn't get access to guns, all that kind of stuff. There were even registries by the government of what weapons there were. And so over time, the country grew more individualistic. You had guns and gun laws. Even in the Wild West, we think of this as six-shooter territory. There's a wonderful photograph of Dodge City, the archetypal frontier town from the 1880s, and it looks like a movie set, and with the saloons and the hitching posts, and it says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited." So even then, you had guns and you had gun laws, and through it all, the one thing people didn't think was relevant was the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court ruled repeatedly that the Second Amendment didn't apply to the states or did not protect individual gun ownership, to the point that in 1991, the retired Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, who was a strong conservative appointed by Richard Nixon, said the idea that the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual right to gun ownership was a, quote, fraud on the public. Attitudes changed a lot over time. It really depended on what people thought of government. Hmm. Now, obviously, that idea sounds pretty quaint because we've really, as a country, have changed our idea quite a bit about gun rights and what the Second Amendment means.
We're talking with Michael Waldman, who's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. His new book is called The Second Amendment, A Biography, and This Is Where We Live. So why exactly did this change if for most of its history the Second Amendment was not considered to be as important as we certainly consider it to be now, if it wasn't as aligned in people's thinking about gun control or gun rights as it seems to be now? What changed to make this the reality that we're living in today?
Well, it's the way we actually make constitutional change and make constitutional law in this country, which is public pressure and public agitation. The National Rifle Association played a very significant role, and other gun rights advocates. Now, the NRA has been around for a long time. It actually goes back to almost the whole way to the Civil War. It was originally focused on marksmanship and training. Eventually, it spoke for hunters and sportsmen all over the country, but it never actually fought very hard against gun control laws. It actually supported a bunch of them. And in 1977, there was a contentious fight at the annual meeting of the National Rifle Association. To this day, it's known as the Revolt at Cincinnati. And 1,000 activists came to the meeting and voted out the old leadership and voted in new leadership that was much more militant and much more ideological and very much focused on the Second Amendment and the idea that that meant you had an unlimited individual right to gun ownership. And they reshaped the entire NRA around that idea as a constitutional crusade so that these days, today, if you go into the headquarters of the NRA in Virginia and walk into the lobby, there on the wall in pride of place is the Second Amendment, you know, in big letters. But you have to kind of look closely because they've edited it. They actually just edited out the part about the well-regulated militia. And with that vision, the NRA and its allies waged a three-decade campaign to change what we thought that constitutional provision meant. They started with scholarship. They supported a lot of scholarship, and some of it was strong, and a lot of it, I argue in the book, doesn't really hold water when you look at how things were taken out of context, but they supported scholarship because they understood that was important in the way we look at constitutional provisions. They moved public opinion, really arguing publicly, relentlessly, about what the Second Amendment means, so that now it's no longer a fringe position. It's really the mainstream, widespread view. They moved the organs of government. They elected politicians, but also got the Justice Department, for example, to switch its position about what the Second Amendment means. And then, and only then, did gun rights activists go to court. The first time the Supreme Court ever ruled that the Second Amendment recognizes an individual right to gun ownership was 2008. Very recent. That's the case of D.C. versus Heller. But the campaign had been waged so effectively up to that point that it wasn't ultimately that controversial a decision.
What's interesting is not just the clear difference in American life between a time at which there may have been the need for a well-regulated militia, but also so many changes in technology, indeed what arms even are. And it's been quite clear through our history, as you suggested, way back to Dodge City, that there are times at which gun control is part of our legal system. Whether or not that was taken seriously or not is another issue. But I think there's also been enormous technological change that would suggest that the types of weapons we have today are quite a bit more dangerous than the weapons that we had when the amendment was written in the first place. The country has successfully regulated certain types of armaments that you can't own in your home, but it hasn't as successfully regulated other types. What do you think is the reason for that? That indeed it seems that most Americans can say, yes, you shouldn't be able to carry around a rocket launcher, but you can have a handgun for your personal protection.
Right. It's a great question. And you're exactly right that one of the areas of confusion, and some of the scholars who support an individual rights interpretation have made this point too, that weapons technology has changed so much. I mean, a lot has changed since then. Back then, they had militias, but we didn't have police. We didn't have an army. We didn't really have cities at that point. And the guns that people had, the gun ownership that was protected, were muskets, which were, you know, very cumbersome to load. They only could get off one shot. They didn't aim very well, you know. And at the time, they had cannons and that sort of thing, but that's not really what people were talking about. Now, of course, with high-capacity magazines and other things, the capacity for destruction of weapons that are available to people is far greater. But, of course, we also have drones and bazookas and nuclear bombs, and we're really not talking about giving people the right to have their own drone, although I suppose those are the kinds of questions that are going to be grappled with. These nuances are what courts now and society now are wrestling with. Now, dozens of court cases have come up, and overwhelmingly, existing gun laws have been upheld. Courts have said, yes, we've heard the Supreme Court. There's an individual right, but society also has a right to protect itself. And there's a compelling governmental and public interest in keeping these strong gun laws. Now, there are new restrictions, including in Connecticut and elsewhere, with some of these assault weapons and high-capacity weapons. And one of the questions is, well, are those the kinds of the Supreme Court said that guns that are unusually destructive or not in common use can be banned or can be affected, regulated. So you've got 3 million assault weapons in the United States, but there are almost 300 million firearms altogether. So is that a lot or a little? So these are the kinds of questions that we're having to grapple with. My own view is it's better that they be addressed in the democratically accountable branches, in the legislature, in the public debate, rather than going to court and asking judges to try to parse this stuff.
But those
that is where we're at right now.
Yeah, but those democratically elected branches seem to be, for at least the last few decades, as you suggest, part of a change of opinion of many Americans led by the NRA, and certainly that has put some pressure on politicians. I guess, Michael Waldman, I'll leave you with this question. Do you see in the current political structure the way that people have read the Constitution and this amendment as it stands and the Heller decision, as we've seen in the last few years, do you see any substantive change, or are we at this point now in a United States that will allow people to carry guns of various types but will indulge the idea of gun ownership in some way, shape, or form moving forward in a way that I suppose puts us at odds with some other countries in the world?
Well, it's definitely the case, constitution or no constitution, that our gun culture is different from other countries. And some people might think that's a good thing, and a lot of people might think that's a bad thing, but we have far more firearms deaths and injury in this country than other developed countries, even ones with high crime rates. It's just they don't have the guns that we do. You know, so far we have an equilibrium where there's individual gun rights but also strong gun laws. And the real fight is in the political terrain. We don't really know, though, for sure how this is all going to play out, in part because the Supreme Court hasn't spoken again. The question of what kind of limits there can be on carrying guns, not just in your home. The Heller case dealt with having a handgun in your home, which, you know, I think most people would have, you know, certainly the least concerns about, at least as relates to the broad risk of public injury. And we also don't really know how it's going to play out, given the booming authority given to the idea of individual rights to gun ownership that the Supreme Court has now given to that cause. So we don't actually know how it will play out. The one perhaps unexpected bit of hope, I suppose, is that there's a recent statistic that I saw, which at one level is quite horrible, which is that right now, for the first time, more people will be killed this year by guns in America than by cars. 33,000 people. Now, of course, that's a shockingly high number. On the other hand, part of the reason is that cars are killing fewer people, and that's because cars are getting safer. They used to cause much more injury, and they didn't deal with it by banning cars or confiscating them or taking away the right to drive. They did things like raising the drinking age, or putting in airbags, or putting in seatbelts, or other design changes. There are many, many changes in the law, in technology, or other laws that can actually reduce the toll to society of gun violence. And some of those ought to be consensus and common sense. And the only worry, or a worry certainly, is that Second Amendment fundamentalism, the idea that you can't have any restriction on guns, will get in the way of what might otherwise be positive trends.
I'd like to thank you, Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His new book is called The Second Amendment, A Biography. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back from our break, we'll look at the missteps and troubled history of Connecticut's most famous gun maker, Colt. And later, we'll take a look at where the guns in Connecticut come from. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Next month is the 200th birthday of the inventor and industrialist Samuel Colt. The gun-making company he founded is still located in Connecticut, making pistols, revolvers, rifles, and more. It hasn't been an easy ride for Colts, though, as Paul Barrett reported for Bloomberg Businessweek in a story called Why Colt Can't Shoot Straight. Paul Barrett joins us by phone now. Welcome to Where We Live.
I appreciate the invitation.
For us here in the Hartford area, we know a lot about the history of Sam Colt and the Colt's Firearm Company. But I'm wondering first, as we talk about the history of this company and how it's faring right now, can you talk about its place in the gun-making world right now? I mean, we think of Colt as one of the biggest names in guns. Is it still?
Well, it is one of the biggest names in guns, but it is not at present a major commercial force in the gun industry. It is a company that makes high-quality rifles for the military. It makes well-regarded handguns for both the military and the civilian marketplace. But over recent years, other gun manufacturers have basically nudged Colt aside, and I'd say it's now, in a lot of ways, a second-tier company.
What happened to the company to make it a second-tier company?
Its troubles go back a long ways. I mean, you can go all the way back to 1836 and see that Samuel Colt, for all his fame and all of his ingenuity as a handgun designer, was actually himself at first an unsuccessful businessman. The first version of his company actually went bust after 6 years, and he had to basically restart from scratch. But that said, in more recent times, the company fell victim to a phenomenon that affected a lot of American gun companies, which is they forgot about innovation and they allowed quality to slip. And in the 1980s, Colt experienced a series of big setbacks. It lost its main military handgun contract. Then it lost its main military rifle contract. In the mid-1980s, it went through a ferocious labor strike by members of the UAW, and all of those things set the company back to the extent that by 1992 it had filed for bankruptcy and was bought out of bankruptcy by private equity investors in New York. So it was saved at that point, but ever since then it really has struggled to right itself and to become consistently profitable, something that it really has not achieved even in the couple decades since.
People who hear the story of the historic Colt factory would listen to you say that it forgot about innovation and say, but that was the hallmark. That's what drove Colts to success over all those years and, frankly, built all these buildings here in Hartford and created all these jobs.
Yeah. Well, certainly in the first phase of the company's history in the 19th century, that was very much true. Samuel Colt was a great inventor and did revolutionize the at least the handgun market and really made his company a part of American popular culture more broadly. He was an innovator not only in an industrial sense, which he was, but also in terms of marketing, the use of celebrity endorsements, and in terms of the process of taking a specialized product and bringing it to the masses and making it known generally. In the 20th century, Colt remained a very, very important firearm manufacturer, but it did not really innovate in-house. Its great and famous and iconic products, for example, the 1911 semi-automatic pistol and, for example, the M16 rifle, the former was used beginning in World War I all the way through the Vietnam War. The M16, of course, is the rifle we're familiar with from all the images of the Vietnam War, and variants of the M16, now known as the M4, continue to be used by the military today. But those weapons were not designed by Colt inventors in-house. They were designed by outsiders. And Colt actually, to the degree that it succeeded, and it did succeed at certain points, particularly during wartime, it succeeded by manufacturing in a reliable way inventions by other people. And by the 1980s, the company really had run out of gas. I mean, to put it broadly, they were not coming up with new ideas, and worse, the products they were making were not as reliable as they needed to be.
Of course, one of the innovations that Colt promoted for a time in the late 1990s was something that we heard a lot about here, was the smart gun, the idea that you'd have a handgun that only you could fire. This is something that was very controversial in the gun world and something that really got dumped after a short flirtation. What happened with the smart gun?
Well, Colt ran into two obstacles with its smart gun, which, just to explain a little bit further, is a firearm that has a microchip in it, and that microchip allows the gun to be fired only when it communicates with another microchip, for example, that might be worn on a bracelet or a ring or something along those lines. In any event, Colt ran into two problems. One, it had reliability problems. The article of commerce we're talking about here, a firearm, is something that hosts a series of explosions, and including that kind of very, very delicate wiring within the product is a big engineering challenge. But probably even more important than that was the ideological obstacle that Colt ran into. American gun owners, particularly those who are sympathetic to the National Rifle Association, who are very concerned about their Second Amendment rights and very suspicious of government oversight, see the smart gun, whether it's made by Colt or made by others, and other companies have made proposals along these lines, they see this whole idea of personalized weapons not as an advancement so much of safety, but as an opportunity for government to scrutinize and possibly even control their firearms. It's an idea that's viewed with tremendous suspicion by many Second Amendment activists. And for that reason, the idea really has never gotten off the ground, not only with Colt, but with anybody else either.
We're talking with Paul Barrett, who's assistant managing editor and a senior feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. He wrote a big article called Colt's Curse: Gunmakers Owners Have Led It to Crisis After Crisis. We're taking a look at Colt manufacturing here in Hartford. Of course, it's an iconic brand for us here in this area. We're trying to figure out a little bit about its troubles. One of the things I wanted to talk about a bit is what the gun industry has been like since Newtown. You wrote a piece shortly after the Newtown shootings here in Connecticut that was called Get Realistic on What We Can Do About Guns, and you laid out a number of limitations on what can actually happen to change gun culture in America and change gun companies. I guess I'll ask you first, Paul, do you think anything has really changed in the intervening few years since Newtown about the way we view guns or the way gun manufacturers are approaching what they do?
I don't think anything fundamental has changed. I think there certainly is some more debate about the issue. But the larger economic forces at play have been more influential than the political debate. When President Obama was elected in 2008, that set off what's known in the gun industry as the Obama surge, which kicked in 2009, 2010, and into 2011. Out of fear of greater federal gun control, gun owners in this country went out and basically cleared the shelves in retail gun stores of both firearms and ammunition. There's been a huge rally in the gun industry. We had the awful incident in Newtown in 2012, but in a bizarre way, in many people's eyes, that did nothing to interrupt this phenomenon that we've seen in the last dozen years or so, that whenever there's a big incident of that sort, rather than causing a crackdown on gun ownership or gun acquisition, the opposite happens. More guns are sold out of fear of potential stricter gun control. So those have been the more powerful forces. And while there is a lot of debate, and there has been some changes at the state level, including in Connecticut, New York, Colorado, a few other places, overall, today in the United States, it's actually easier to acquire a firearm legally, which is to say if you're not a criminal, haven't been adjudicated to be mentally ill or unstable in some way, it's easier to acquire a gun today than it was, 15 years ago.
And with that, the fact that there was this so-called Obama surge and then people fearing that their guns would be taken away, and so there was a run on guns. I guess I'm wondering why this hasn't translated into better news for a gun maker like Colt. You would think that they'd be booming at this point.
Yeah, good question. One of the illustrations of Colt's difficulties and failures in recent years is that Colt did not benefit nearly as much as a number of its rivals, companies like Glock, Smith & Wesson, Sturm Ruger, in response to the industry rally that we've been talking about, the Obama surge. Part of the reason for Colt not cashing in, so to speak, is that the company was really distracted through this same period by a lot of financial engineering as opposed to gun production. It was split apart into two companies, in 2002, Colt Defense on the one hand making guns for the Pentagon, and Colt's Manufacturing, the traditional name, which was left behind as kind of a very weak civilian-oriented company. And then, you know, 10 years later, the company was recombined, and in the interim, the owners of the company took a lot of cash out of the company while they actually went out and borrowed a lot of money against the company's assets. So they've ended up now, after this, the rest of the industry has been feasting on all these sales. Colt did see some increases of its military sales, but those are now trailing off with the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Colt is not as strong on the civilian side, but meanwhile, they do have this huge debt load that they've built up over all this time. So they've, again, been distracted by a lot of financial engineering that didn't do a lot to increase their profile in the civilian marketplace or really lay the groundwork for a strong performance in the absence of two wars overseas, which are now, which is good news, winding down.
Well, with all of that, I guess I'm wondering if in the future, not just for Colts, but for all of the traditional gun makers, if you think there's just going to be a massive change, as we've seen with, say, American car makers over the years, where as these wars wind down and maybe the American government decides not to get into long, protracted ground wars in other places, and as it seems that states will only pass tougher gun laws over time, as opposed to more lenient gun laws this last few years notwithstanding, do you think that we're going to see more consolidation, fewer traditional gun companies? I mean, what do you see as the future?
There has been some consolidation in the gun industry, and yet it still remains a very fragmented industry. I think we will see more consolidation in the future, more of these traditional brands being bolted together into larger companies in the interest of trying to seek efficiencies. And I think Colt is one of those brands that we may see in coming years consolidated into a larger company. The company right now is not on strong financial footing. And one solution for that problem would be for the Colt brand to be combined with some other brands, perhaps under a management and ownership structure that was a little bit more farsighted than the one that's been in control to date. So I think that is very possible. I also think another possibility is that places like Connecticut will see some of their traditional gun manufacturers leave for friendlier environments, friendlier in the sense of having less strict gun control. Colt itself has been making noises about possibly moving, for example, to Florida, and I think that still remains another possibility that people in Connecticut are going to have to deal with.
Yeah, we've already seen some gun-making jobs move south, and then prior to that, prior to some of these changes in the industry, we saw the Winchester rifle brand close up shop in New Haven. This is something that seems to be following historical trends of a lot of manufacturing going out of the Northeast. I'll leave you with one last question, though, something we've talked about on our program before. You know, we're coming up on the 200th birthday of Sam Colt, and people like Bill Hosley, who I know you know, who's a biographer of Sam Colt, they're trying to figure out how to thread the needle of talking about this historic moment of someone who helped build the capital city of Connecticut, but also how we talk about that in the context of today's gun discussion, which is so divisive and causes so many problems for so many people. What are your thoughts on that, of how we celebrate this Colt name while also really keeping it in perspective of what guns mean in America today?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and our attitudes toward firearms have shifted dramatically over time. Certainly, in Sam Colt's time, the current debates we're having now, and the symbolism, what a gun stood for, was different. I do think people who are devoted to firearms, whether they're collectors or they're sportsmen, or there are people who've served in the military, or for whatever, you know, or hunters, whatever the reason, it seems to me there's absolutely nothing wrong or inappropriate in celebrating the history of a cherished article of commerce, the way, you know, car aficionados celebrate cars, and these days, you know, computer fanatics are on the edge of their seat about what the next product is going to be from Apple. But guns are different because of their, you know, incredible potential for misuse, whether criminal misuse use in suicide or other unhappy contexts. And for that reason, I think people who celebrate guns have to have a certain or ought to have a certain sensitivity to the dark underside of firearms, which is to say, you know, while they represent good things to many people, they also have a potential for misuse, and people need to be sensitive to that. And I'm sure people in Connecticut, you know, home to Newtown, will have that in mind, and I hope that they'll, you know, they'll take a balanced sort of moderate approach to it.
Paul Barrett is assistant managing editor, and he's a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. He's written about the Colt's manufacturing company, Why Colt Can't Shoot Straight. We'll have links to this article on our website, WNPR.org. Paul, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll check in with a ProPublica reporter who worked on a project to track where firearms that are recovered in Connecticut originally came from. You can join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll revisit some conversations we had with recipients of the 2014 Student Stowe Prize in conjunction with the Harry Beecher Stowe Center. We'll talk about the role of women in politics, and we'll look more closely at local and national juvenile sentencing laws. Later on in our program tomorrow, we'll hear music from the Puerto Rican guitarist Giovanna Garcia. Hope you can join us. Today, we're continuing our conversation about guns. ProPublica recently published a report, Where Do the Guns Traced in Your State Come From? It's a state-by-state look at the origin of guns recovered by U.S. officials in 2012. Eric Segarra is a news applications fellow at ProPublica. He joins us by phone. Eric, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us why you wanted to track where the guns come from in each state in the nation.
I think it was just a very interesting data set that we came across that showed where federal authorities were able to trace weapons to within the different states. What happens is a state or local official will request a federal trace of these guns, and the federal authorities will conduct that for them and trace back to the first point of sale. And then make a note of that. So it gave us a chance to take a look at where these guns were coming from and where they were going.
When you talk about guns being recovered, maybe you can just flesh this out a little bit more for us. Are these guns that were used in crimes, guns that are being traced by law enforcement? Explain what sort of guns you mean.
These are firearms that were where officials recovered through some means or another. It doesn't necessarily have to be a violent crime. It could be, you know, somebody carrying a gun someplace where they shouldn't be. It could be a violent crime, like I said before. Anytime a state or local official decides to check out the history of a gun, they do so through this system, and the ATF records the trace and traces it all the way back to the first point of sale, first point of retail sale.
So how many total guns across the United States are we talking about here?
In 2012, it was roughly 155,000 guns.
So that's an awful lot of guns, but I'm going to assume that is just a small, small percentage of the total number of guns that we have out there in America.
That would be a pretty safe assumption. This is also not all guns that are recovered by state or local police officials. They don't always request a trace, so we can't see those guns, so to speak, in the data.
So they don't always request a trace. There are some guns that I assume are used in crimes or maybe recovered by police that are very, very hard to trace. How do you account for that, the fact that many guns that are being used in America today are illegal or not purchased legally anyplace at all?
From what I understand, what I can see reading my background of the different firearm data sets that are out there, it's something that's very difficult. Particularly gun ownership alone is still very difficult for researchers and the like to track through the data.
So let's get down to some of the specific numbers for our state, Connecticut. How many guns traced here actually came from other places?
They traced, in 2012, 624 guns in Connecticut, and they found that about 44% of them, 275 guns, were originally purchased outside the state.
So 44% purchased outside of the state, places like New York, North Carolina, and Florida. One of the things that we've often heard from officials here in talking about gun control is that despite whatever sorts of rules we might have about purchasing firearms here, an awful lot of the guns that we get are coming from across state borders, many of which clearly are coming from states with much less restrictive gun policies than we have. Is that fair to say?
I would say that, you know, regardless of what happens, you're going to see guns traveling across borders. If you look at District of Columbia, where you can't buy a gun, they still have quite a few guns that were recovered and traced to sources outside the state.
When we talk about 44% purchased in other states here in Connecticut, how does that stack up to the rest of the country? Are other states pretty much in the same boat, or are there outliers in the statistical range?
There are a few outliers, but I would say that it starts to be, I would say, on the low side. Texas, for example, 18% of their guns recovered were traced outside the state, and that's one of the lower numbers in the country. And it goes all the way up to, 60, 80%. In the case of D.C., like I said before, every gun was traced to a source outside of D.C.
Obviously, these numbers are relatively small given the total number of guns in America. What are some things that you would tell people who are looking at this data set as we put up on our website, WNPR.org, for the first time? I mean, what are some cautions for them as far as how much you can draw from the data that you've collected and dispersed here?
Well, I would say, first off, keep in mind that this is not necessarily all the guns that law enforcement officials have recovered. Also, these aren't necessarily weapons that have been used to hurt somebody. They could just be guns that somebody had in the glove compartment or on their person, and they were somewhere where they were not supposed to be at the time. And this does not necessarily mean that these guns were actually taken out of circulation. It could be that the trace on the gun was run, it was found to be a legal weapon, and it was given back to the person who was in possession of it.
A last thing for you, as we look at data like this, do we have the same sorts of compliance from law enforcement around the country? I know that when it comes to collecting some statistical data on varying crimes around the 50 states, one of the things that hamstrings people who are doing reporting like you or even federal law enforcement is that the statistical gathering of data is a little bit different from state to state. Is there any worry about that here?
I think that's a problem that you have with most data sets that have to deal with firearms. And I know there are other tables within this data set that we stayed away from precisely for that reason. This one seems to be the most accurate number that the ATF is able to provide, and it seems based more on their data collection than the states. The only real area that is a bit of a problem is the fact that not all states or not all agencies run traces on every single gun that they come across. So this number that we have published here is actually probably going to be fairly light by thousands nationwide.
Eric Segarra is a news app developer and reporter at ProPublica. You can see where do the guns traced in your state come from. The state-by-state look at the origin of guns recovered by U.S. officials in 2012 on our website, WNPR.org. It's a tool developed by ProPublica. Eric, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.